Me. When Hamdi tries to speak, the growls turn towards him. Are you wanting to attack us? Asks Hamdi. All three of you, says Matar. Both doctors glance at each other. They start to talk at once in English and Arabic. Relax, Matar, it's okay. You know who we are and why we're here. You wanted to come and talk to Helen about your condition, remember? Matar nods. He seems to be trying to fight the urge to attack. He takes a few deep breaths and suddenly becomes quite lucid again. He says he needs a cigarette. Raphael slips from behind the desk and helps him out of the room. With Matar gone, I turn to Hamdi and ask his opinion about what has just happened. I don't think he's taking his medication, Hamdi replies. Matar usually takes a mixture of antipsychotics, antidepressants and anti-anxiety drugs, he says, which help control his symptoms. Something must have happened to make him stop taking them. I don't think we are safe in this room. I agree and suggest we end the interview here. Hamdi disagrees. He says we should just move to a bigger room. You should sit by the door so you can run out if you need to. I am feeling terrible about the possibility of making Matar's relapse worse, but follow doctor's orders. I get the feeling that this is a rare opportunity for Hamdi and Raphia to find out more about the condition, to understand it better. We walk to a large seminar room, set out with rows of chairs. While we wait, I ask Hamdi why it is that Matar's schizophrenia has manifested itself in this rare belief that he can turn into a tiger. Why does this happen to him, but not to others with the condition? Hamdi says that is the million-dollar question. There's something different going on, he says. People with lycanthropy see their bodies not as human, but as animal. We have to ask, how is that possible? We may not be able to find out the answer from studying people with lycanthropy. There are just too few around. But that's not to say we can't make some inroads. You don't need to be suffering from lycanthropy to feel as though your body is changing shape or altered in some way. There are many strange disorders in which people feel like their limbs are unwanted, are present when they're not, or have grown smaller or larger. Some of these can give us clues to what might be happening to Matar. But to find out more, we need to travel back to 1934, where a young man is lying in a surgical theatre, head shaved, brain exposed, and wide awake. Wilder Penfield gripped the tiny electrode and lowered it to the surface of the young man's brain. He pressed a button and a tiny current ran through the metal rod, giving the surface of the brain below a small jolt. "What do you feel?" he asked his patient. "I feel a tingling sensation on my jaw," he said. Penfield's assistant made a note of the result and placed a marker onto the area of brain that had just been stimulated. Penfield moved the electrode a fraction of an inch and began the process again. This time the patient felt a sensation of being touched on his upper arm. We met Penfield in Chapter 1 when he was stimulating an area close to the hippocampus to produce flashes of memories in his patients. This time, he was trying to identify which areas of his patient's brain were causing epileptic activity and needed to be removed, and which healthy tissue he should avoid. He would often start such an operation by identifying the central sulcus, a prominent indentation at the top of the brain that separates the frontal lobe from the parietal lobe. Just in front of this landmark is the primary motor cortex, a strip of tissue that contains cells that travel down into the spinal cord, where they connect with motor neurons that terminate in our muscles. Just behind the central sulcus is the parietal lobe, which contains a similar strip of tissue called the primary somatosensory cortex. This contains cells that receive information about tactile sensations from all around the body. When Penfield stimulated the primary motor cortex, his patient would feel the sensation of movement of a specific muscle. When the somatosensory cortex was stimulated, he would feel the sensation of being touched. Using hundreds of these operations, Penfield was able to create a cortical map of the body in the brain. In doing so, he discovered that the body is mapped within these strips of tissue in a familiar order, meaning body parts that are adjacent in real life were adjacent in the brain. So an area of the somatosensory cortex that provoked the sensation of touch on the upper leg would be close to an area of the brain that provoked the sensation of touch on the lower leg. This, in turn, would be next to an area responsible for the ankle, the foot, the toes, and so on. Penfield illustrated these body maps using what is now known as a homunculus, an image of a grotesquely squat man with extraordinarily large hands, fingers, lips and tongue. The homunculus is disfigured because it represents the size of the brain area devoted to a given body part, and each area is proportional not to the body part's physical size, but to how richly innervated it is by muscles or sensory nerve endings. For instance, the sensory homunculus has disproportionately huge lips and hands because they are extremely sensitive to touch and therefore take up a lot of room in the brain. Areas such as the torso and upper arms are tiny on the homunculus because they have fewer nerve endings and therefore take up less room. These maps are important in giving us a sense of what our body looks like and where each part of it is at any given moment. This may sound strange. Perhaps you think you know what your body looks like because you can see it. But visual stimuli are not the only way you can sense your body. Close your eyes and stretch out your hand. Now touch your nose. You can do it despite not being able to see any of your body. And that's because embedded within the brain is a model of what your body should look like. An internally generated image that scientists sometimes call our sense of bodily self. In order to create this image, Penfield's motor and sensory maps work together with what's called a proprioceptive map, which processes information about your joints and movements. These maps aren't static. Every second of the day they are being updated to give you a fluid sense of where your body is, what it feels like, and what it is doing. If you start to put on weight, for instance, your visual sensations of a bulging midline and internal sensations from the skin and muscles both contribute to update your brain's internal body schema. It's not clear exactly where your final body image is produced, although there is some evidence to suggest that the superior parietal lobe is involved. Stroke patients who damage this area sometimes fail to recognise their limbs as their own. What we do know is that when all these body maps are communicating with each other, it produces the feeling of owning a body that matches the physical reality. The problem is that sometimes this system goes awry, and that's when we start to feel a little out of sorts. Take, for example, the phantom limb, a phrase introduced in 1871 by the American neurologist Silas Weir Mitchell. People with a phantom limb experience an amputated limb as still present and sometimes painful. After Lord Nelson lost his right arm during the Battle of Santa Cruz de Tenerife, he referred to the subsequent sensation of pain in his missing limb as proof of the existence of the soul. For if an arm can survive physical destruction, he said, then why not an entire person? We now know that this is not proof of a soul, but of something else quite extraordinary, neural plasticity, or the brain's ability to reshape itself throughout our life. When someone has their limb amputated, areas of the brain that once received input from the amputated limb are now neglected. The brain doesn't like to waste precious real estate, so when one limb is erased, the rest of our body image quickly expands to take its place. This is why phantom limbs occur. Brain areas that once processed touch to the arm might now be taken over by neurons that process information about touch to the face. This can lead to the sensation that an amputated arm is being touched, when in fact it is the face that is being touched. Often these phantom limbs become painful. A phantom arm might feel like it is frozen or clenched in a fist. It's likely that motor regions of the brain are still attempting to send commands to the missing limb, but are getting nothing back. These mixed messages make it seem as if the phantom limb is paralysed. A simple trick can help relieve this pain almost instantaneously. The person sits with a mirror between their remaining limb and their phantom limb. Looking in the mirror provides an exact replica of the limb where the phantom is felt. Unclenching the fist, or moving the real limb, gives the impression that the phantom limb is making the same action. In this way, people can soothe pain or even make their phantom limbs disappear altogether. You don't need to have lost a limb to discover what it's like to incorporate a phantom limb into your body image. Take a blown-up rubber glove and two small brushes and place the rubber hand on the table in front of you. Conceal your own hand with a piece of wood or cardboard. Now get a friend to brush the rubber hand repeatedly at the same time as brushing your real hand. Once the illusion kicks in, you should start to feel like the rubber hand belongs to you and that you can feel the brush strokes directly on it. This is the most famous example of how easily our body image can be altered, but there are many others. In 2011, Vilina Ramachandran and his colleagues wrote about a new condition that they called xenomelia, in which otherwise rational individuals are overcome with the desire to amputate a healthy limb. Ramachandran's first subject was a 29-year-old man who recalled a strong desire to amputate his right leg from around the age of 12. He said the leg made him feel overcomplete and he simply wanted it gone. He readily acknowledged that these feelings were not normal. A month after first visiting Ramachandran, he poured dry ice over his lower leg, forcing surgeons to perform an amputation. Many doctors claim this was just a cry for attention or a result of psychological trauma from early exposure to an amputee. But Ramachandran argued that it was much more likely to have an identifiable biological mechanism in the brain. When we ask these patients to draw a line across their limb for where they wish it to be amputated, then ask them to draw it again a month later, the line is in the exact same place, he told me at the time. It was just too specific to be down to an obsession of some kind. To prove his point, he worked with the neuroscientist Paul McGough, also at the University of California, San Diego, to analyse four people with xenomelia who wished to have one of their legs amputated. The experiment was simple. They scanned each patient's brain while touching their legs. The results were startling. When subjects were touched on their normal leg, or above the line of amputation on their unwanted leg, there was a significant burst of activity in their right superior parietal lobe. When they were touched on their unwanted limb, activity in this area didn't change. The team say that the right superior parietal lobe is an area of the brain that is ideally positioned to unify disparate sensory inputs to create a coherent sense of having a body. They propose that xenomelia occurs when someone finds themselves in the unnatural situation in which they can feel their limb being touched, but that sense of touch is not incorporated into their body image. The result is a desire to amputate the seemingly alien limb. Interestingly, something similar might explain why transgender people often feel at odds with their anatomy. Recently, Laura Case at the University of California, San Diego and her colleagues recruited 8 people who were anatomically female but identified as male with the strong desire to have male anatomy. They also recruited a group of non-trans women as a control. To find out if there were any significant differences in the way their brain processed information about sexualized body parts, Case and her team scanned each participant's brain while they were tapped on the hand or the breast. As you would expect, stimulation of the hand and breast caused the corresponding areas of the parietal lobe to light up with activity. But in the trans group, this activity was significantly lower when their breast was touched compared with their hand. We have a chicken and egg problem with both these studies. It's impossible to tell whether the brain differences are a cause or consequence of a lifetime's aversion to a specific body part. Nevertheless, both experiments clearly demonstrate the importance of our internally generated body image, and specifically the parietal lobe, in helping us achieve that image. But can it also help to explain the presence of lycanthropy? There's one early sign that it might. In 1999, Hamdi came across a 53-year-old patient who suffered from epilepsy and severe depression. For some time, she found it difficult to escape the belief that she had claws growing out of her feet. A brain scan showed a loss of tissue in one side of her parietal lobe. It was the first hint that when people with lycanthropy report their bodies changing shape, they may be genuinely perceiving those feelings. We also know that people with schizophrenia show a higher susceptibility to body illusions such as the rubber hand trick mentioned earlier. Brain scans suggest that this might be explained by a stronger reliance on sensory information from vision and movement over weaker stored body representations. It could suggest that in some extreme cases, a visual hallucination of claws or an animal's face might be more easily incorporated into one's sense of body image. Unfortunately, Matar's brain scans have not yet pinpointed any abnormalities. That's not to say there aren't any. Several doctors I have spoken to about the condition think that the unexplained nature of lycanthropy, as well as schizophrenia in general, might be revealed with better neuroimaging techniques with higher resolution than currently available. There are many hypotheses and partial solutions, but we need to scan more patients and do bigger studies before we can make any conclusions, says Hamdi. So for now, we continue to treat Matar's schizophrenia and hope that this also helps his belief that he can turn into a tiger. Back in Al Ain, Rafia comes into the room, followed by Matar and three young doctors. During his cigarette break, she had learned that Matar's mother was away with his sister in India. His sister had started to show signs of schizophrenia and was being tested at a specialist hospital. Rafia seemed to think that Matar had stopped taking his medication, and his anxiety about his mother being away had exacerbated his symptoms. Matar walks across the room, seemingly in better spirits. He sits in one of the front seats. "I'd like to carry on," he says, looking at me. I smile, thank him, and ask again if he could tell me how he knows he is a tiger when he gets these feelings, rather than any other animal. This time he answers immediately and fluently. "I don't know why I'm a tiger. I just know I am. I hear lots of voices around me, telling me I'm no good. They laugh at me. They tell me I'm rubbish, that I'm not good enough to be human. Some days it feels like there is a lion around me. Sometimes it is attacking me, grabbing the back of my neck. I can't move from the pain. I can see the blood coming from my body where I've been attacked." "Do you ever feel like you can defend yourself?" "No," he shakes his head. "I can't defend myself from the lion, as it's much stronger than me, so I feel like I have to attack first." "How long does it last?" "Sometimes only a few minutes, sometimes hours." Hamdi interrupts. "Have you been feeling like this recently, or has it just happened today?" he asks. "It started last night," says Matar. He looks upset. "I was in bed and I felt it coming on, so I locked the door, put a towel over my head, and wrapped myself up in my sheets so that I couldn't move my arms or get free." He says that once, when he could no longer resist acting out his urges, he attached cement blocks to his shoes to make his feet too heavy to move. "I just wanted to stop myself from hurting anyone." "Have you ever looked in the mirror when you felt like a tiger?" I ask. "Yes," he says. "I've looked at my reflection when I felt like a tiger, and I see two things. I see myself as a tiger, and I see a lion that's catching hold of my head and my neck. I can't rationalise it. It's very frightening." Despite his behaviour today, Matar is not thought to be a danger to anyone. His medications generally allow him to function well in society and live safely in his local community. "We're happy to have him live at home. He has his family and a community nurse to look out for him," says Hamdi. "It's different here than in the UK. There's a big emphasis on family helping to care for people who are ill." I turn back to Matar. "Is there anything you can do to help prevent your delusions from occurring, other than take your medication?" "I always wear white," he says, pointing at his white long-sleeve robe and headdress. "It's calming. White feels like a peaceful colour to wear. It helps when I have these weird feelings." Suddenly the atmosphere changes again, as Matar laughs out loud. He stretches his fingers out wide and bends them at the knuckle. He lowers his head and slips off his shoe. Then he grabs his left leg and grimaces in pain. Suddenly the snarling starts again. "I think we should leave," says one of the doctors sitting beside me. Another asks Matar if he would like some medication to help with his anxiety. He nods and, with barely a glance, walks out of the room and is gone. This is the point where I'd love to add that Matar is now well, that a mixture of drugs and psychotherapy has helped him banish his delusions. Unfortunately, that's not the case. A few months after I returned home, I emailed Rafia and asked her to translate a note from me to Matar, thanking him for coming to meet me. I wanted to know how he was feeling. Rafia replied quickly. She said that Matar's behaviour on the day of my interview suggested a fairly severe relapse and that he continued to have repeated admissions to the hospital. So far, she said, he has not returned to an acceptable level of functioning. Matar's brain may be unique, but there are many lessons we can learn from such extreme cases, not least the incredible power of family in ensuring the health of those who may otherwise find themselves in permanent care. If you place people with lycanthropy side by side with others that experience perceived body alterations, though, what emerges is a picture of the brain working tirelessly to create a sense of something that most of us take for granted every day, a body that feels like our own. Chapter 7. Louise, Becoming Unreal. I think it's time to ask you a question. Who are you? It seems simple enough. There are many ways that you could answer. When we think about who we are, it's often from the perspective of others. I might think about myself as a journalist, a daughter, a friend, a wife, a James Bond fan. But what else constitutes me? As Matar showed us, part of me is my body. Mine is fairly tall and slim. It has big feet. But another aspect of me is also present inside that body. I am made up of emotions, memories, thoughts, opinions, and bodily sensations that all carry a feeling of being mine. The body I see in the mirror changes day by day, but the person inside that body is constant. Scientists like to call this our sense of self. This attachment to our thoughts and sensations seems like something that should be fairly permanent, yet that is not always the case. In his diary, the Swiss philosopher Henri Frédéric Amiel describes a peculiar feeling. I find myself regarding existence as though from beyond the tomb, from another world. All is strange to me. I am, as it were, outside my own body and individuality. I am depersonalized, detached, cut adrift. Is this madness? These feelings were later defined as depersonalization disorder, a condition in which a person feels detached from themselves, as if their external and inner worlds have become unreal, as if, as Amiel put it, they are no longer tied to their own mental experiences. Some people describe it as feeling as though they are watching a movie of themselves, or that their perception of the world has decreased in quality. You might have had some experience of this yourself. It's thought that brief episodes of mild depersonalization are common among the general public, typically at moments of high stress or fatigue. That spaced-out feeling that you get when jet-lagged or hungover could be seen as a transient experience of depersonalization, for instance. A number of drugs, including ecstasy, have also been associated with the onset of such feelings. Depersonalization can appear suddenly without any apparent trigger, or after severe stress or childhood trauma. There are some theories that it is a protective mechanism, that in the face of extreme danger, our sense of self can detach itself from what's happening in the world in order to remove itself from the stressful nature of what's going on. This idea struck a chord with me because it brought back memories of a fleeting feeling of depersonalization that I had experienced one morning driving to the dentist. The road was wet and the gravel and fallen leaves had washed to the bottom of a T-junction near my house. As I braked to meet the end of the road, my wheels skidded and I drove full pelt into the oncoming traffic, spun and crashed into a lamppost. The entire episode not only felt as though it was happening in slow motion, but also felt like it was happening to someone else. As soon as the brakes stopped working, I remember a distinct feeling of detachment from my body, like it didn't quite belong to me. I remember thinking back to my driving lessons and whether my driving instructor had told me anything about what to do in this situation. I decided he hadn't and then proceeded to feel angry about his lack of foresight. Then I recollected someone pumping the pedals during a skid in a film I had once watched, so I tried that. After that didn't gain me any traction, I remember searching the oncoming traffic to work out which car I was likely to hit. I felt like I was watching myself get closer to the end of the road. I remember thinking about whether there was any way I might warn them and tried to look apologetic as I neared the unsuspecting driver. After hitting the first car and spinning 180 degrees, I remember thinking it was strange that the airbag hadn't worked and then trying to figure out how best to position myself to minimise the damage for the second impact. It was almost as if my physical body was not quite me, like I was watching it all happen from somewhere inside my own head. This slow-motion catastrophe ended as my car eventually came to a halt across the road. If these were feelings of depersonalization, they were short-lived. As soon as the lamppost buckled the front of the car, the pain down my shoulders dragged me back into myself. But for some, this feeling of depersonalization, this detachment from your sense of self, is a permanent way of life. I pull into a tiny back street, lined with colourful terraced houses. The rain is lashing down and the cobbled road is so small even my Mini is struggling to make a three-point turn. I'm in the seaside town of Brighton, down on the south coast of the UK. I lock up the car and dive for cover as the door to the nearest house opens and a small child grins out at me. "Are you Helen?" he says. I follow the child into his house. "Hello," I call. Louise suddenly appears at the top of the stairs and beckons me up. From the living room, two more kids stare out at me. "Hi," she says brightly. "Sorry it's a bit hectic around here. They're not all mine. Tea?" This was not the same Louise that I had met a few years previously. Back then, sitting in the Tate Gallery in central London, she had seemed distracted, wary, exhausted. She had gazed blankly at the people around us. She had said that she felt like she was in a play, and that everyone around her, including me, were the actors. She felt completely detached from the world. "I can hear myself speaking to you," she'd said. "I know rationally that this is my voice, but it doesn't feel like it's mine. None of this feels real." Now, standing in her kitchen with the kettle boiling, Louise looks like a different person. Her blonde, wavy hair has changed to a deep shade of brown for a start. But the real difference is in her eyes. A year before, they had seemed distant and unsure of the world. Now they are clear and focused, and she is smiling, confident, and cracking jokes about the havoc in the next room. Louise pours out two cups of tea and then points me back down the narrow flight of stairs. When we were out of earshot, Louise says, "When I get depersonalised now, I don't panic. I just tell myself it's not real, it's just my brain. Nothing has changed, this is still my arm, this is still my house, and just get on with the day." She opens what I had assumed was the garage and welcomes me into a brightly decorated tiki bar. "I converted it a few years ago," she explains. The room is filled with glasses and candles and strings of lanterns with tribal masks and leis hung on the wall. I settle myself on a bar stool and ask Louise to take me right back to the beginning. She was 8 years old and off sick from school the first time it happened. "I woke up that morning and suddenly felt like I'd been dropped into my body," she says. "It's really hard to describe, but it was like I was just born. Everything around me felt new. It's like you are completely different to what you were a second ago. A completely different you. You're suddenly really aware of where you are and who you are, and everything around you feels foreign." She pauses. "Everything about yourself and everything around you feels alien. You know rationally that it can't have changed, but it's like you're walking around in this world that you recognise but no longer feel. It's like this unshakable sense of detachment from your body and the world." "Ah!" she groans. "It's so hard to explain." Louise, like many with depersonalisation, has great difficulty describing her state of mind. No eloquent metaphor seems to sum up her feelings accurately. She tries one more time. "It's like you're watching the world, but are no longer part of it." Her first few bouts of depersonalisation were brief. "As a child, it only happened for a few minutes at a time," she says. "I would panic and run to be around others, but I never talked about it with anyone." "Why not?" "I don't know, I just thought it was really weird. I didn't want anyone to think I was crazy." This is where depersonalisation differs from schizophrenia. This disturbing feeling that your experience of yourself and the world around you has changed is not accompanied by any kind of psychosis. The people who suffer from this disorder never lose the ability to distinguish what is real and what is not. "You never truly believe that you're part of some alternate reality, but that's part of the problem," says Louise. "You know rationally that these weird feelings that you're experiencing can't be real, that the world you are in hasn't suddenly changed, but it still feels like it has. That's why it's so frightening. It's worse than being away with the fairies. It's like being a sane person who is mad." The first time that Louise's depersonalisation became really bothersome was at university. She had been suffering from a migraine when suddenly her world became distant, separate from her body. She was floating around, she says, in a world that she was no longer part of. This feeling stuck around for days at a time. Then it started lasting a week, and then longer. Eventually it just set in and wouldn't lift. Finally I had to leave university. I became permanently anxious, like that feeling you'd have if you tip backwards on a chair and are about to fall. I'd feel like that all the time. I couldn't stop thinking about how weird everything felt. I thought I was going mad. It was just terrifying, she says. Despite this inner turmoil, it was not immediately obvious to those around Louise that there was anything wrong. She knew rationally how she should be behaving, so her actions appeared perfectly normal to others. Yet she spent years feeling isolated, frustrated, and fearful. After countless visits to doctors, who shrugged their shoulders in response to her weird concoction of symptoms, Louise became depressed, terrified of the constant anxiety attacks that would coincide with these bouts of unreality. "Sometimes," she says, "when it's at its worst, I can't have any noise in the house. When you're in this state, everything around you feels like it is screaming at you to get noticed. But at the same time, your whole world seems like it's happening to someone else, someone you're not in control of. It's like walking through tar. It's exhausting." "And there's no way of ignoring it," I ask, "by concentrating on the rational part of your brain that's telling you everything is okay." "No," she replies. "Saying think positively is like trying to fix a leg that's been blown off with a plaster." She's quiet for a while. "Have you seen that painting by Edvard Munch?" she says suddenly, "with the face screaming against an orange sky. Some say it is about depersonalization." In the 1800s, Munch created four pieces of artwork called The Scream in Nature. The pieces are made from oil, pastels and crayon, and each shows a ghostly figure with a skull-like face looking out from the canvas, its mouth wide open and with hands on either side of its cheeks. The sky behind the figure is made of red swirls, and there appears to be water in the distance. Two people stand close by, seemingly oblivious to the figure's turmoil. Expressionists of the time often placed emphasis on painting their inner feelings and emotions rather than a realistic image. "It's not the chair that should be painted," said Munch, "but what a person has felt at the sight of it." In a poem he inscribed on the frame of The Scream in Nature, he said, "I was walking along the road with two friends. The sun was setting, the sky turned blood red, and I felt a wave of sadness. I paused, tired to death. Above the blue-black field and city blood and flaming tongues hovered. My friends walked on. I stayed behind, quaking with angst. I felt the great scream in nature." "That painting makes perfect sense to me," says Louise. "The person and the landscape are screaming at you. It's exactly like depersonalization. When it happens, you can't get any peace. It's not only the outside world that seems strange, but your internal one too. Everything you're familiar with becomes alien. You're detached from everything, even your memories. Memories of things you've done suddenly don't feel like they belong to you. It robs you of your past. It takes away the core of who you are." "Your memories don't feel like your own?" "Yeah, you just feel separate from everything that you thought you were. Your memories, your voice. I mean, I know this is my voice and these are my memories, but when I'm in that state, they don't seem like mine. I know I'm controlling what I'm saying, but it's like I'm in a film, like it doesn't belong to me. It's like I'm on my own in the centre of everything and no one else is real. It makes you feel very separated and lonely from everything, like you're the only person in the world that is really here." A few years before we first met, Louise ended up in hospital. She had just given birth to her second child. "I'd had illnesses running up to the birth, and I'd felt really odd throughout the pregnancy," she says. "When you're in charge of someone else, and you're not feeling like you're in charge of you, it's just the worst. After the birth, it was the first time I really relaxed. But then I went into the shower, and suddenly the weirdness hit me again. I had this massive panic attack. My whole world closed in on me, and everything went black." 2 months passed, which Louise says were a blur. "I can't really remember anything between giving birth and having to go back to hospital. I just couldn't manage anymore. It had come to the forefront of my mind, and I was so overwhelmed by it all, I just couldn't think of anything else." Her husband could see there was something wrong, but it wasn't obvious to him what it was. "Everyone kept asking about depression and whether I had suicidal thoughts. I told them that any bad thoughts were only there because I wanted to get these weird feelings to stop. I had a little baby and I wanted to get on with my life. It was just one massive nightmare. It was like being in hell. I wouldn't wish it on anyone." After first meeting Louise, I paid a visit to an online forum for people who suffer from depersonalization to learn more about the disorder. I browsed through some of the posts. One member said he had an acute feeling of forgetting who he was and the way that humans live. "I feel like I'm just an alien from another dimension pretending to be human the best I can," he said. "All my memories are there, but it's like I can't trust them. My brain won't accept and assimilate them." Another described themselves as a frame, not even a shell. All that was me is no longer there. Some appeared to be confined to their houses, unwilling to spend their day interacting with people who didn't feel part of their world. One regular contributor did the opposite. He walked 10 miles a day, yet still felt nothing. "I'm so fucking numb I can go anywhere, do anything, and I won't feel a damn thing." There seemed to be a common theme of emotional numbing of one sort or another. I asked Louise whether she too felt she lacked emotions towards people and her surroundings. "When I think about it rationally, I do have an emotional attachment to others, my parents or my husband, for example. But if they are around and I'm feeling depersonalized, then it's like the room is your play and the space in front of you is your set. They're all just actors. So at that point, I don't feel any particular attachment or emotion towards them or the things around me." I'm struck by this peculiar paradox. Louise and those in the depersonalization forum all talk about an emotional numbness and disconnection with themselves and the outside world, yet all suffer strong feelings of subjective distress over this weirdness. As in Munch's painting, they say that the world seems to be screaming at them, yet they feel like they're not part of it. How is it possible to feel nothing and everything all at once? The answer, it seems, begins with a rather unusual murder. In the summer of 1921, William Hightower told a newspaper reporter that he had been digging in the sand at a popular spot at Salada Beach in California, hoping to find some bootleg whiskey that he had been told was buried there. While digging, he said, he had uncovered a black prayer scarf that he believed belonged to Father Patrick Heslin, a local priest who had gone missing a week earlier and who had been the subject of several ransom notes. Eager to claim a reward for having found Heslin, Hightower returned to the spot with a reporter, who brought with him a team of police. They started digging. One of the policemen told Hightower to be careful where he was digging, as he might strike the face of anyone buried below. Hightower told the policeman not to worry, as he was digging at the priest's feet. Hightower was arrested, and Father Heslin's body was uncovered. The San Francisco Call and Post arranged for Hightower to be hooked up to a new piece of machinery, the cardiopneumopsychograph, invented by John Augustus Larson, which was quickly renamed the lie detector by local press. Larson's technology incorporated a test for blood pressure, with tests for skin conductivity, pulse, and respiration. He believed that fluctuations in these bodily functions were an excellent means of detecting guilt. Hightower was the first person to trial the technology. On the 17th of August, the newspaper's headline read, "Science indicates Hightower's guilt." Police later found in Hightower's hotel room the pistol used to shoot the priest, the typewriter used to write the ransom notes, and some sand. While the wild gyrations of the lie detector were never reliable enough to be fully accepted by the scientific community, it was one of the first demonstrations that our unconscious bodily functions are linked with our thoughts. Have you ever been told to go with your gut or to follow your heart? We talk about leaning on our bodily sensations all the time, but there's more to this than a figure of speech. Take your heartbeat, for instance. Think about it now. Can you feel it pumping softly against your breastbone? Perhaps it's pounding. Or maybe you are struggling to feel it at all. Take a moment and try counting it without touching your chest or feeling for your pulse. Is it more difficult than you thought? When asked to count their heartbeat for a short time, 1 in 4 people are out by about 50%. Our ability to sense the physical condition of our body is called interoception. You should be familiar with this concept, even if you don't realise it, since with the exception of a few, most people can sense whether they are hot or cold, where a pain is coming from, whether they are thirsty or hungry. These are all interoceptive feelings. Scientists tend to use the heartbeat test as a way of measuring our interoceptive capability. Each of us has a different capacity for such bodily awareness, and we now know that this ability is intimately connected with our thoughts, feelings, and social behaviour. People who are more in tune with their heartbeat, for instance, are better at reading their own emotional feelings. People who are better at interpreting their own feelings are also subsequently better at interpreting the emotions of others. People who have greater interoceptive abilities also make better decisions based on subtle cues in their environment and can make intuitive choices more quickly. They can judge the passing of time more accurately and also perform better in tasks that require them to divide their attention. One noteworthy example of how interoception affects our thoughts comes from the journal Social Cognitive and Affective Neuroscience, in which the Argentinian neuroscientist Agustin Ibanez describes the man with two hearts. The gentleman in question had heart disease, and so Ibanez replaced his failing heart with a mechanical pump. Unfortunately, his patient disliked the sensation of his second heart, which was implanted just above his belly button. The mechanical throbbing sensation made it feel as if his chest had fallen into his abdomen, he said. But interestingly, the sensation of his second heart also affected his behaviour. His new heart did not react to external events like his original heart. Before his operation, he had no problems empathising with others. Now that his mechanical heart roared, he had problems reading others' motives, he lacked empathy when looking at painful images, and even had difficulty making decisions. It supports a theory first proposed by William James in the 19th century that we may be able to register what's happening in our external world in an intellectual and rational manner, but it is an awareness of our body's reaction to the world, our beating heart and sweaty palms, that conjures up our rich emotional response to that world. Some of the most influential work in this area has been carried out by the Portuguese scientist Antonio Damasio, who describes emotions and feelings as two separate things. Emotions, he says, are the brain's reaction to certain physical stimuli. For example, if a rabid dog starts barking at us, our hearts might race, our muscles contract, and our mouths go dry. This emotional reaction happens automatically. Our brain then attaches value to this emotion. Is it rewarding, strong, or negative, say? Our feelings occur only after we become aware of the physical changes to our body and start to form a conscious representation of that emotion, something we then attach a word to and call our feelings. You can test this idea right now. Start by clenching the corners of your mouth. Slowly pull each side up. Then a little bit more. Now open your mouth slightly, squeeze your cheeks up towards your eyes, and there you have it, you're smiling. Stay like this for a moment. Do you feel better? You should. Scientists have shown that the physical act of smiling actually makes you feel happier. According to Damasio's theory, the brain notices the muscle movements associated with smiling, attaches all the positive values it knows are associated with this reaction, and creates the feeling of happiness. Recent studies have suggested that the brain region responsible for integrating all the information coming from our internal sensations is the insula, a fold that lies deep in the centre of the brain. One promising theory suggests that information coming from the body is collated and integrated in the back and middle areas of the insula before being re-represented by the front or anterior insula, which generates the feeling that pops up into our consciousness. The anterior insula is the area of the brain that forms a default setting of "this is me, here and now," says Nick Medford, a consciousness expert at Brighton and Sussex Medical School. Medford spends much of his time placing people in brain scanners and showing them pictures of grotesque surgery, filthy bathrooms and cockroaches, images designed to elicit aversive reactions. When we look at these kinds of highly evocative stimuli, the insula lights up with activity. When Medford showed 14 people with depersonalization these images, however, he found a startling lack of activity, specifically in the left anterior insula, compared with people without the disorder. The study also showed some evidence that a region called the ventrolateral prefrontal cortex might also be involved in inhibiting the insula's response to the gruesome images. This area is known to keep our emotions in check. In people with depersonalization disorder, it seems to be overactive or too controlling. 10 of the 14 people with depersonalization in Medford's study had their brains scanned again, 4 to 8 months after receiving a drug used in mood disorders. Those who showed increased activation of the insula were the same people whose symptoms had improved. Those who showed improvements also had decreased activation in their ventrolateral prefrontal cortex after taking the drugs, whereas it was still active in those whose symptoms had persisted. Medford figured that if people with depersonalization had a suppressed neural response to the world, then this would also be apparent in their body's autonomic reaction to stimuli. In this context, the word autonomic refers to the things that happen in the body that we cannot control, the basis for Larson's lie detector test. Medford focused on skin conductance, a way of measuring when the skin momentarily becomes a better conductor of electricity as we become aroused. When this occurs, sweat glands become more active and conductance increases. Skin conductance is one of neuroscientists' favourite tools since it allows us to gain an objective insight into our emotional responses. You can't fake a sweaty palm. And neither could those with depersonalization. No matter how grotesque or displeasing a picture, people with depersonalization showed few signs of their body reacting. Somehow, their body's automatic response to the outside world has been dialed down and is not integrated into subjective feelings about themselves or the world around them. But why does this create the sense that they do not own their own voice or that the world has become unreal? It turns out that the explanation might be related to something we have already come across, the idea that the brain makes sense of the world using predictions. As we saw in Chapter 5, the brain does not process every single aspect of the sensory input it receives from the body and the outside world. Instead, it makes a best guess at what those inputs might mean. If it makes an errant prediction, then it either updates future predictions or creates a perception of the world that better suits the input it is receiving. This prediction model might also explain depersonalization disorder. When everything is working well, the brain makes predictions about things that are happening inside the body, and these match with the actual signals it receives. This culminates in feelings that can be attributed to you. If there is something wrong, however, a problem generating or integrating internal signals, say, then the predictions that the brain makes about the internal state of the body and the actual signals it receives don't match up. Perhaps, to make sense of this confusion, your brain then attributes bodily signals and the feelings they produce as coming from someplace else. The result is the sense that you are no longer attached to your body or your thoughts, and that the world around you is going on without you being fully part of it. And once this peculiar feeling sinks in, it appears to be hard to avoid ruminating over it. This, in turn, can lead to our earlier paradox. Despite feeling numb about the world around them, people with depersonalization can still feel an overwhelming sense of internal anxiety. Her month in hospital was the last time that Louise wondered whether she was going mad. During that time, she was referred to Medford. "I went into his office and told him about what was going on. I was so upset. I just felt like I was the only person in the whole world who was feeling this way. But he turned to me and told me that it sounded like depersonalization disorder. I just thought, oh my God, I'm not insane. It was such a relief to hear that it was a condition, that I wasn't psychotic, and I didn't have a tumour. It made it all a lot easier to deal with." Some people with depersonalization find certain mood stabilisers can help control their anxiety, but they are not effective in all cases. Others, like Louise, find cognitive behavioural therapy works well. This generally helps those with depersonalization to break out of the vicious cycle of obsessively dwelling on the strangeness of their internal and external worlds, which can exacerbate their symptoms. Louise was also shown how to separate her depersonalization symptoms from those of anxiety and depression. "Now, when it's at its worst, I can handle it in a much calmer way. I tell myself it's all right. It's just a process happening in my brain. Don't panic. Nothing is wrong. I'm still me. That's the important thing. Now when it happens, the rational side of my brain is quicker at responding to it, so that I don't get the absolute panic that was there before. Louise sits back on her barstool, and we listen to the rain hitting the garage door for a moment. It is strangely peaceful, despite the noise and the bright colours all around us. "I'm not saying that I'll never freak out about it again," she says, "but I feel like I'm prepared for it now, so I don't think it'll ever get as bad as it once was. I've got my weapons now." Suddenly, little footsteps pad down the stairs and a semi-naked toddler waddles into the room. "Thank God it's not the same with Morgan and Martha," Louise says quickly and emphatically. "I've read about people with depersonalization completely dissociating from their emotions. I do have that with the people around me, but not with my children." She stares at Morgan. "Never with them. They actually saved my life. If it wasn't for those two, I would never have got through this and come out the other side." After saying my goodbyes to the children, I head outside and back into the pouring rain. I sit in the car for a while, watching the water slide down the windscreen. It has a calming effect on me, a feeling that only occurs because of the seamless integration of my internal and external worlds. We may think with our brains, but as Aristotle argued all those years ago, we really do feel with our hearts. I find it incredible that our most basic feelings of existence are underpinned by an ability to sense the internal state of our body, and that being good at it can help us in so many ways. I wondered, was there any means of getting better at it? It is often stated that meditation can help increase awareness of our internal body, but there is little scientific evidence to back this up. In fact, when Sahib Khalsa at the University of Iowa tested a group of experienced meditators who practiced either Tibetan Buddhism or Kundalini Yoga, he found they were no better at detecting their heartbeats than non-meditating subjects. Many other experimental attempts to manipulate interoception have also proved ineffective. It seemed, for a while, that our interoceptive awareness was robust and unchangeable. However, in 2013, Vivian Ainley and her colleagues at Royal Holloway, University of London, showed that the solution may have been staring us right in the face. Her team asked 45 participants to count their heartbeat while staring at a photo of themselves, or at six words that describe themselves, such as their first name, their hometown, and the name of their best friend. The participants were significantly better at this task when looking at their own photo or staring at these words than when they looked at a picture of someone else or at six random words. It's not yet clear why this works, but the team suggests that focusing on self-referential images and text may enhance the accuracy of interoception by shifting the brain's attention from the outside world to the inside world via the insula. It has clinical implications. It might help not only people with depersonalization, but also people with more common disorders such as anorexia and depression, both of which have been tentatively linked to low levels of interoceptive awareness. Whether this kind of training will lead to persistent levels of increased interoception is yet to be investigated. But when we're surrounded by a growing industry of brain training apps and smart drugs that promise to give you a competitive edge in this world, I like the idea that we might be able to make better decisions, improve our attention, and become more empathetic simply by looking in the mirror. Chapter 8. Graham. Waking up dead. Turning off the main road and into a maze of one-way streets, I eventually find the entrance I am looking for. I pull up, climb out of the car and stand, watching an old man in a white baseball cap furiously squirt weed killer onto a patio tile. He holds his back as he straightens up to take aim from another angle. When he turns to look at me, I quickly walk away, embarrassed to be caught staring. I'm surrounded by aisles of mobile homes propped up on bricks, their yellow, blue and brown cladding faded, a casualty of harsh British winters. Today, however, the sky is blue and I can hear the squawk of seagulls hovering nearby. Following an unmade path further into the estate, I finally spot my destination in the distance. Outside a tiny brown bungalow, a man is standing, hands in pockets, clearly waiting for somebody. His face is turned away from me, and I slow down, momentarily delaying our introduction. Suddenly, the man turns and looks in my direction. Helen? I smile nervously and nod my hello. I have no idea how to begin this particular conversation. Graham is 57 but looks older. His face